Okay, good morning, everyone. Okay, happy Monday. Election day is tomorrow. This morning, we have the honor of having Lieutenant Governor Greg Bell speaking to you. As the state elections officer, he's going to speak to you also about leadership. For my state and local government class, remember exam number 3 is on the horizon already for December 5th, okay? So as I indicated in an earlier email, Lieutenant Governor has to leave no later than 8:40, and then his assistant elections director, Mark Thomas, will continue until class is over at 9:25. So with that in mind, let's welcome our Lieutenant Governor. Okay.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you this morning. I admire you being here bright and early. It's better coming off daylight savings times than going on, though, isn't it? Today I'm going to talk about leadership, and then I'll leave some questions. And then Mark Thomas, who's my elections director, as was said, will come and finish out the class, and you can talk more specifically about election issues. But you know, politicians deal in leadership. We all do. Heads of family, heads of clubs, heads of teachers are, principals, university presidents. Anyone who works around people typically has to deal with the issues of leadership. And so this is just a very simple construct that I work with, and this is the way I see leadership. First of all, when Bush 1 was president, the issue was asked whether he was a visionary. And so he said, oh, that V thing, that V word, right? Vision is the V word. And so you start with, number one, a vision. And just think about Romney Obama. I mean, really, there's a very, very stark choice between President Obama's philosophy and Governor Romney's philosophy. Think about Jefferson Davis and Abraham Lincoln. An incredibly different view, vision, if you will, of how things ought to go. And this wasn't just messing around, right? This wasn't just some Friday night chatter. Because when Abraham Lincoln was elected, his election began the Civil War. The very fact of him being elected precipitated the Civil War because the South understood what he believed. It was very clear in his lectures and his debates in 1858 with Stephen A. Douglas how he viewed slavery and the division of the states. And so visions make a big difference. We don't have time to go into the Romney vision of America and the Obama vision of America, but you guys have picked up on it, and you could tell me as well as I could tell you what that means. And so people are caught, their attention's engaged, and their emotions often are also engaged in support of or in reaction against one vision or another. Now, some candidates, some leaders don't have a vision. And they start out below that. For instance, Romney has been my brothers throughout all the primary just could not stand Romney because they felt like he was a technocrat, meaning that he had no vision. He just was a fixer. He just wanted to come and get his fingers on the dials. You know, Federal Reserve ought to do this, and then we'll cut the money supply, and we'll stop inflation, and then we'll turn this dial over here, and we'll have more jobs and that sort of thing. So there's a question, you know, did he really have a vision? Did Bush 1 have a vision? After Reagan, who was the mountaintop visionary, you know, Reagan was the one who sat up on the mountaintop and said, oh, okay, these are the green uplands with the city on the hill, you know, that sort of a thing. Well, not everybody has the same ability to conceive a vision, but still, they all do in one form or another. And maybe it's a smaller vision or maybe it's a technocratic vision, but at least it's a set of objectives and goals that they share. So once you have a vision, the vision needs to embrace a couple of things. A, It needs to embrace, this goes without saying, how things should be. So we're going to say how things will look or will be. Now sometimes that's a call to return to old values. In the Nixon years, it was, let's go back to the traditional families. Crime was a huge issue in the 70s. And so safety and crime and just the safety of the streets, that was a real calling of Nixon. He wanted security. It was called a law and order appeal, law and order society, right? So A is how things should be, and B, what problems exist as barriers. So we can get to the sunlit uplands if we overcome the intervening hills and snow and weather and et cetera, et cetera. So you can't start necessarily with just problems. I mean, you can, but it's not engaging. It's not statesmanlike. It doesn't precipitate any interest. It doesn't. Then you do seem like a technocrat. I'm running for student body president, so I can fix the sidewalks. And you can state that, you know, but that's rather a negative statement of your vision. Probably a more appealing way is saying, I want this campus to have free physical access for people of all abilities and disabilities. You know, that's a more positive statement of vision, so that we can have integration and diversity and have everyone enjoy the benefits of campus. Okay, so those are little subtle differences, but they're big differences in the event. Because if you keep referring back to the negative problem, then people, you might convince people, don't elect that guy, but it's not of a statement of why you ought to elect this girl, right? So there's a yin and the yang to that. So vision is how things should be, and problems is barriers, how are we going to overcome the problems? The next thing is number two, is two steps really, and that is it's solutions. So you've identified, here's the vision, here's where we want to go. We now live in New York, and we want to live in California. There's no railroad. How are we going to get there? We can take the railroad to St. Joseph's, Missouri, and then we've got to have a wagon built, and then we're going to go across the plains in this very nice wagon, and we've got to beat the weather over Donner Pass, or we're going to eat each other, right? So you've got a problem, but you also have an ultimate goal. Where are we going to arrive? And so everything you do is defined within the context of A, the vision, and B, the problem, and now C, what are the solutions? Okay, so that addresses both the vision and the problems. So you can call it solutions or paths. So you can talk about joblessness, and this is a crummy economy, and the government's in our way, and there's not a level playing field, and companies are disincentivized from forming jobs. There's a lot of that. But you can also put it on in a positive spin. We need to incentivize entrepreneurship. We need to incentivize invention and development and research and that sort of thing, so that we can have more jobs, so that our students can get out of college and have jobs in science, technology, engineering, and math, even in political science and public administration. So you've got to develop the solutions and the paths. And that's the hard part, right? That's really the hard part. Most people are able to tell you what's wrong, but most people aren't able to tell you how to get out of what's wrong. Now, all armchair philosophers think they can solve problems, but they rarely account for the real problems on the ground. And they particularly fail to account for political compromise. And if I were your teacher and I were preparing you for a test, I would emphasize that, and I would put a big essay question about that. And why is that so? If Obama is successful in winning election, is he going to be able to enact his agenda? What are the barriers he would face? The what?
The Republican-controlled
House. Right. So Congress, the Republican, control the House. I mean, the Republicans are not going to lose control of the House, right? So Obama and Harry Reid, you know, they can have all the little tete-a-tetes they want and say, okay, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. But if Boehner's not there, and if Boehner's boys stick with him, then they can't do anything, really. I mean, the president has executive declaration powers, executive order powers, but in my opinion, they've been stretched beyond the constitutional limit. But still, he has that. But apart from that, you've got to do things through legislation, right? So that's where classes like this teach you the difference between theoretical armchair politics, sitting around Saturday afternoon with you, your uncles, and saying, hey, those rotten buggers, here's what you ought to do. And it's amazing that people, when I was a senator in the legislature, sometimes when people would call me with their solutions, I would just say, really? Did you finish high school? Have you ever had anybody disagree with you? Have you ever lived anywhere where there was more than you? Like, were you married, or did you ever have friends or a girlfriend? Or, I mean, come on. If there is more than one person involved, then you've got practical politics, right? Where do you want to go eat? Do you just hang out with people that always just exactly want to go where you want to eat and see exactly what show you want to see? And, you know, why do we fight over remotes? Because people disagree. You get three people and you elevate it from television to politics. People kill each other for stuff like that. So for people to just come in and say, oh, here's my vision, we're just going to do it. Come on. I mean, really, that's what this whole deal about politics is about. It's about learning to cooperate and creatively compromise. I gave a speech to some constitutionalists. These guys are, okay, here's the right wing, and here's the ultra-right wing, and here's the fascists, and here's, right over here you start dropping off and you become a communist or something on the other side. Anyway, these guys were way over there. So I said, all right, and I was talking about the Constitution, and I've studied the Constitution a lot, I'm a lawyer, and I said, you know, you guys have made compromise a dirty word. And, you know, some people stiffen and they hear this attack of this liberal guy, you know. And I said, the Constitution is the living proof of the logic, beauty, appeal, and necessity of compromise. And this one guy, I can tell, man, he's either going to walk out or he's going to start swearing. Or hitting, I don't know. I hope swearing, not hitting. And so finally I said, he's not buying it, you know. So I said, look, the Constitution has so many compromises. Consider, why do we have a Senate? Why do we have a Senate? Because they couldn't agree on large state, small state, right? I mean, it just makes sense to have representation per population. It's just, that's intuitive, isn't it? You got 2 million people, you get four representatives. You got 1 million, you get two. And so the small states are going, nope, we're not playing. So they came up with this idea, well, look, the states are forming this union. This isn't a union. And the people of the states aren't really doing it. These are states. These are sovereign entities, sovereign governments. Delaware is a sovereign, standalone entity. And if it has three people, it's still standalone sovereign. And New Hampshire, same thing. But Virginia and New York, with the population, are going, are you kidding me? You think a Delaware is equal to a New York? You think a North Carolina is equal to a Virginia? No way. Well, what'd they do? They came up with two houses. A house based on population and a house based upon equal representation. So you've got the Alaskas and Wyomings with 500,000 or 600,000 people have how many senators? Two senators, right? One senator per 250,000 people. California with 36 million has two senators. One senator per 18 million people. So a Feinstein is equal to a Barrasso or something. I mean, it's really quite unique, isn't it? Anyway, we could show you all the compromises. So solutions, paths, and let's set that aside as another thing. Because you're going to set forth a program, and then you're going to need to begin to compromise. Okay, the fourth thing, and it probably should go a little higher, but this is the gist of leadership, and it's called articulating the vision. And this is a tricky deal. Because there are so many brilliant people, so many creative people, so many people with solutions, but they're not articulate. And so they don't get elected. And so you get empty suits like me because you get people who can articulate more as politicians. And it's an outsized reliance on expression. It really is. You look at the great speakers, they tend to be our great leaders. Franklin Delano, Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Thomas Jefferson was a horrible speaker, but he was really lucky to have lived before television. And Lincoln would have been awesome on radio, but he was just an ugly, clumsy person. And with television, he'd have been toast. He'd have never made it. We would never have elected that incredible man. And it's unfortunate, isn't it? But that's the reality. So who do we have? You know, we get Obama, you know, young, handsome, virile, athletic, polished. He just, when he starts talking, you know, you just see the upland meadows opening up, don't you? I mean, he just really opens a vision for you. Reagan, same thing. And, apart from philosophy, they just have this ability of articulation. Let me give you an example. In 1935, people who were watching Germany realized that we were going to have big problems. Hitler had put out all the leadership in Germany, had started taking over the government, and was becoming very, very aggressive internally. And then pretty soon he would start absorbing the Sudetenland and Austria and moving into... He would start moving over into Poland, and he just expanded the borders to the hereditary German lands, you know, and it was all in the guise of, well, we're just uniting the ethnic Germans, right? Well, the Cassandras of the time, Winston Churchill and others, were saying, you guys, England and the U.S. are completely unprepared, entirely unprepared for war. I mean, the United States had these old World War I vintage ships. We didn't have any planes. We didn't have machine guns. In the battle up for Midway, the torpedo planes, all of whom but one, were shot down. You know, we had something like, what, 40 of our youngest, best pilots drop torpedoes without fighter support, and these torpedoes were dropped at four aircraft carriers, the Japanese aircraft carriers. You know how many torpedoes exploded? Zero. So these young men were all killed because for nothing. They made no damage, no difference. Because our industrial might was not, it didn't exist. We couldn't even explode a torpedo. Clung, nothing happened. Or they went like this. It was just really unbelievable when you realize the state of unpreparedness England and America were in. Well, all right, so you have this rising Nazi threat, and they're just swallowing up countries by the day, and we've got Charles Lindbergh, who's kind of like Brad Pitt today, or George Clooney, a very charismatic person who's got a great voice in America, who's leading out, and he's saying, America first. We don't need to fight European wars. We're not going to get caught in that European mess like we did in World War I, where we lost a whole generation of young men in trench warfare. We're not going to do that. And the people are saying, yeah, we'll stay out of Europe's problems, you know. Well, Roosevelt is talking to Churchill, and he sees the mounting threat and realizes that there's no way. You've got Japan on the march down through northern Asia and then over into China, down into the Philippines and Sumatra and Indonesia and Thailand and Burma over here. I mean, it's just going to be a rout. We've got the Axis power of Italy, kind of the junior partner, had just taken over Ethiopia and starting to take over northern Africa. So you had Nazi domination on almost the entire European continent, then Italian domination down into into Africa, and then Japan was starting to have hegemony over China. I mean, think about that. You know, I mean, owning China, which they did. It was just amazing. Well, Roosevelt couldn't get the American people to be worried about it. They just kept saying, and British would come over here. Remember the Battle of Britain in 1940? We wouldn't be in the war for a year and a half. We wouldn't be in the war, practically speaking, for 2 years. And the Brits are taking all this pummeling, this bombing of London, and Roosevelt can't get the Americans engaged at all. And so he starts this process of lend-lease and some other things I don't have time to go into. And then he begins to articulate what needs to happen. And there's a real push-pull here, okay? And this is the push-pull of a leader leading, a leader teaching. A lot of what a leader has to do is teach. He has to show the people the vision, because they don't see it. You know what I mean? A woman said the other day, well, what does the national deficit have to do with my little life? You know, why should I be worried about $16 trillion? Well, right now, not much. But in a year when inflation, you know, ramps up to 10 or 12% because we're printing this much more money, or when we have a financial crisis because of sequestration and schools lose their federal money and all of a sudden defense contractors are putting thousands out of work, you know, or when people start buying our bonds and interest rates go up and we can't service our debt, then she's going to be very, very involved. But how, as a leader, do you teach her today that she should be concerned about it? And how does Romney say, look, you need to elect me because I understand what that's going to do to you, and if you elect me, I'll help avoid the problem. If she doesn't see it as a problem, and the alternative is, don't worry about it, we owe it to ourselves, it's no big deal, then she's not going to vote for Romney, you see? So we have this push-pull. It's the leader teaching, the leader making the citizen aware of, if you don't vote for me, if you don't get prepared, then the Nazis will overrun Belgium, Holland, Norway, France, and own all of Europe, and they're going to make a play for Britain. If they'd have landed in Britain, if Stalin hadn't come into the war, Britain would have been toast, and we would have been facing Asia, Europe, and Africa, all solidified in Axis command, and America alone would have stood against that. Well, Congress then, in 1940, do they respond to this? No. They pass laws restricting the president against selling anything or excessing, surplusing anything to combatant nations, staying neutral, right? And so it's this push-pull of teach, take a public poll, you know, what is the public thinking? Okay, I can't get too far out ahead of him. Come on, guys, you know, and you look back, there's nobody there. He's got to be reelected in 1940, right? So it's not like he can just do what he wants. So there's the great push-pull and the necessity of articulating that as well. And then finally, should you be fortunate or unfortunate enough to be elected, then you have to actually do business, and you have to bring practical solutions and concrete steps. So, when FDR gets elected in 1932, and Hoover has been, you know, nervously wringing his hands like Hamlet, we're doing this, we're doing that, you know, what does FDR do? He does a whole bunch of stuff. Some of it was theater, but it was a lot of activity. Declared bank holidays. He said that some of the banks needed to be weeded out. We'd support those who lost money. He put into effect all kinds of emergency measures, and he gave the people hope. He said the only thing we need to fear is fear itself, and he put into effect concrete steps to achieve a program, and he articulated where he was taking the nation. And he pulled them along, and then they would push back. The Supreme Court would rule that's unconstitutional, so he'd pull the people more. And then the Supreme Court ruled it was unconstitutional, and so he did this, and it was unconstitutional, so then he threatened to pack the court, and all of a sudden the court found it in its heart to give him majorities in support of his previously unconstitutional measures. And you see what I'm saying? Whether you agree with him or not, as a leader, he exerted leadership. He articulated a vision. He had practical steps. He pushed the people. They pulled him back. Then he pulled them along, articulated the vision. They came. They didn't, you know, it was always this back and forth. But finally, he got the people to where he wanted them to be, and he got them to see the vision he saw, and things started clicking along. So anyway, I've got about 5 minutes for questions, but this is just my little, how I would articulate how, what the leadership path is for a political leader. Get a vision, tell people how things should be in a very affirmative tone. B, identify problems as the barriers. Number two, set out solutions and paths to success. Number three, be prepared to compromise, sit down with your opponents and say, how can we get you involved in this? Because there needs to be a win for everyone to play here. And number four, become very articulate about your solutions and understand that just because you think it and just because you say it in a speech doesn't mean the people are going to follow. Governor Herbert has a goal to have 66% of our populace have a degree, a technical certificate, or a professional designation, an apprenticeship, or a professional certificate by 2020 to fulfill the manpower needs of the state of Utah in our 2020 economy. Well, it's 66 by 2020. Anybody heard of that? Okay, well, we have just probably 20% have heard of it. Well, you guys are going to be part of that workforce. We've developed that over the last year, so we need to help you know what it is, understand it, and bring you along in the vision. We need to articulate it to you better. And that's going to be our goal in the next 3 or 4 years. Okay, questions? Yeah.
Hi, my name's Chase. I was just wondering which one of these five for you was the hardest to put into practice or to learn to do. You said one and two were the tough ones to do, but for you, which one was the hardest? Because to me, I think articulating things would be the most difficult.
Okay, well, I'm a visionary by nature. Okay, I'm not saying I see the right vision, but I am visionary. I don't have a problem with that. And I can see how things ought to be. And I'm a natural bargainer, compromiser. I just tend to create consensus, not a problem. I'm fairly articulate. And the problem, and I teach people, I'm patient. I can push, pull. I can hear them and tell them and try to bring them along, create a dialogue with my constituents. My problem is coming up with practical solutions because I'm an idealist. And so I go at problems in a binary fashion. Even though I'm willing to compromise, I try to solve problems very directly. And a lot of times they don't work. And I wish I had more time to explain. But I can't tell you how clever a lot of the resolutions are, resolution of problems in the Utah legislature. Someone will come along realizing, now, wait a minute, here's a political briar patch, here's a forest, here's a swamp, here's a hurdle. I'm not going to get through those. Utah Taxpayers Association is not going to let me do da-da-da-da-da. And so they come up with a solution that is elegant in the sense of it'll work, but it will also either neuter or involve opposing parties, right? So I find that I have to have a partner. I have to find someone who can help me find politically palatable solutions, because that's not my gift.
Thanks. My name is John Christensen. I have a question about leaders a little bit lower than your office in our state. Part of your job, as I understand it, is dealing with the financial disclosures of candidates. As a former senator and in your capacity of being charge of the financial disclosures, if you look on that website, you find that the campaign contributions to certain candidates sometimes go toward sort of their own personal expenditures that have absolutely nothing to do with running a campaign, such as paying the internet bill, buying wedding presents for people, or going on to conferences after the campaign. What do you personally think about that as a former senator and in your capacity of being in charge of the financial disclosures?
Great question. This young lady had a question, too. Well, campaign funds are... you had your hand up. Did you want to... campaign funds are for really two functions. Number one, running a campaign. But there's also the need... Relative to what money I used to make, I'm not making a lot of money. I mean, for me, it's a sacrifice because I'm making like 30 or 40% of my former income. So I have to travel to a lot of conferences. I mean, it was absolutely essential for me to be at the Republican National Convention. I was the highest-ranking state official supporting Mitt Romney. You know, I mean, I could miss, but I really needed to be there. Well, it's not fair to ask the taxpayers to pay that, right? And I don't have the resources to do it. And so the custom has grown up that you pay for that out of your political action fund. And, you know, wrong or right, that's what you do. Now, you know, buying a new dress for my wife for the inauguration.
There are people on the list that have done stuff.
I know they do. And that, you know, because of foolishness, you know, will lose the ability to do what isn't foolish, right? People will always push the limit. But by and large, the money awash in Utah politics is not all that awesome. In other words, I remember the Trib ran, you know, the lobbyists lavish $200,000 on legislators. Well, that's $2,000 a piece. Okay? Mugs and T-shirts and pencils and pop and, you know, donuts and stuff like that, you know. I mean, half of it is just crap. Really, literally. Newspapers on your desk in the morning, you know what I mean? It's not going to change the balance of things. You're not going to, at least I think most people aren't going to be moved around because somebody gave them a donut or because somebody hosted in the Senate lounge. You know, you got the dietitians hosted the 10 o'clock muffin break, you know, or Utah State brought their Aggie ice cream down. So at that level, I'm not too worried about it. Trips and conferences, you know, when I was an attorney, when I was a city official, we went to conventions. We went to places where we learned and had interchanges with our colleagues, and I find them to be quite valuable. I don't go to every lieutenant governor conference, but I try to go every 2 or 3 years because I learn a lot. And there we'll interface with Congress. We'll interface with the Justice Department, who's saying, I'm going to sue you, state leaders, if you don't da-da-da-da-da, or implementing the Military and Overseas Voters Act, or cooperating with Pew, or something like that. So I'm just saying there's a virtuous side, but there are always idiots and some greedy people who are going to ruin it for the rest. So, yeah.
Real quick, my name is Mary Meller. I'm a political science student. And my question is, assuming you're reelected tomorrow, can you give us like the 30-second spiel about what your vision is for Utah for the next 4 years?
Yeah. Number one, a prosperous economy brings everything good in society. And, you know, some people are left behind, but when you have jobs available for people, good jobs for you guys and for the rest of our society, it's just wonderful. Colin Powell just spoke at Park City last month, and he said the most powerful force on the planet today is wealth creation. Here's a guy that commanded the largest army in the world, and he said the most powerful force in the world is wealth creation. China, by its capitalistic embrace, has brought 400 million people out of poverty in the last generation. You show me a welfare program that can touch that. If a person has a family-sustaining wage, you know, making $75,000 instead of $25,000 a year, then homes are more stable, kids are more stable, they don't worry about hunger, they have clothing, they have shelter, they can go to school, they can go to college, they can start to be generous in their community. So an economy is absolutely vital. Number two is hand in glove with a good economy is a great education system. Being able to go to the University of Utah and afford it is a blessing beyond description, really. I mean, I meet with people from Mali and the Congo, and these lovely people are dying to have some distance learning classes from Utah or Utah State. I mean, they're racked with war. They can't even get their country stable enough to have an education system. And so as we develop, retain a first-class education system and expand the opportunities for particularly our diverse population to get a great education, then they will participate in democracy, they'll be more active, they'll be bigger contributors. So that's it. And then the third one is energy development. We have to responsibly develop our energy resources and get our fuel prices down. We've got to solve some of these environmental lockups where, you know, we can't develop because it seems to be irresponsible, and environmentalists are sometimes very responsibly saying, no, you can't, you know, that's not a good thing. Or, in my view, irresponsibly are saying, no, we want to live with candles in caves, you know. That's an overstatement, but that's kind of the cartoon characterization. You know, so it's a great economy, great educational system, and energy independence. Well, I got to run, but it's been delightful to be with you. Let me introduce Mark Thomas is the elections director in my office, and he forgets more before breakfast than I remember all year. So I'm here for the big, high, puffy stuff, and he's here for the real concrete questions. And great guy, young man. This is a young man, graduated from the University of Utah, how long ago? 6, 7 years ago? And has just by dint of talent and hard work and intelligence risen through the ranks. And he has no pedigree. He's just a normal kid like you and me who became, rose to the fore because of ability and hard work. So Mark has my complete confidence, and I'm going to turn the time over to him, and he can talk to you about election issues. But wonderful to be with you. Thank you very much.
This morning we have Mark Thomas, as was stated by Lieutenant Governor Greg Bell, who's currently the Director of Elections, and he's been there for 6 years. He graduated from the University of Utah in political science, and he actually completed a few Hinckley internships. He's married, lives in Salt Lake City, and has 1 6-year-old daughter. So let's turn the time over to Mark.
Well, good morning. Again, I'm Mark Thomas, Director of Elections with the Lieutenant Governor's Office. I went to school here at the University of Utah and graduated in political science. And during that time, I did several internships here locally and in Washington, D.C. But I ended up getting a job when the Herbert administration came in and worked in the elections part. I was able to work my way up there. And then when Herbert left to become governor because of Huntsman left to China, at that point I became the director of elections there. So I like elections. It's a lot of fun. There's a lot of moving parts, a lot of details that have to be watched over. There's also the political side of it that is always interesting with the issues that come up. One of the real reasons I got involved is because as a younger person, I used to deliver newspapers, and I used to love, you know, reading the headlines. And after a while, you start recognizing names, you start recognizing issues, and then you want to start seeing, okay, well, how was that issue resolved? And then you start looking, you know, towards later editions to see how the issues were resolved. So that's how I got my interest in politics and the election side. But as you all know, tomorrow's election day. Our office has been gearing up for that for a couple of years. I mean, we knew that tomorrow is going to be probably the biggest election day in Utah's history. We have the redistricting that occurred, which moved a lot of the districts around, reapportioned it. So that puts a lot of seats that perhaps weren't into play. It also raises the interest of folks. So you have that. Of course, the presidential race is a popular one. All of the constitutional offices are up for elections. You have the Senate, the House, local races, constitutional amendments, ballot propositions. I mean, there's quite a few. How many have voted so far? So it's about 30-35%. That's about what we're seeing statewide, and as far as folks voting before Election Day. And that really changes campaigns, if you think about it. Instead of waiting for just one day, now voting begins starting 45 days before the elections. Our office, in conjunction with the county clerks, send out the military and overseas ballots 45 days before the elections. And then 30 days before the elections, we send out the rest of the by-mail ballots out to everyone else who's requested. And this year, we've had 250,000 people request by-mail ballots, and over 120 have already been returned, and it's not even election day. So that's an issue that campaigns are having to deal with. You're starting to hear more and more now about campaigns getting information from our office about who's voted. What our office does is supply reports to candidates that shows day by day which voters have voted. We don't show how they reported. We just show them as voting. It's put in place by our office so we can identify who's voted, and so if they try to come back again, then we'll know that we'll say, hey, you know, we see that you've already voted. You've been given credit for voting, and so it is a security mechanism. But since we have that information, campaigns love it because now, you know, they can, you know, get rid of 40% of the population and focus on those who haven't voted. You know, a couple of, let's see, in 2010, a couple years ago, you saw the Mike Lee campaign. He actually sent a letter out to folks saying, giving them the names of their neighbors who hadn't voted yet right before Election Day. And it said, you know, dear so-and-so, your neighbors, you know, Mark Thomas, Greg Bell, they haven't voted. Will you go encourage them to go vote? And quite frankly, I don't think that sat well with a lot of people. First of all, I don't think people understand this information is public. You know, it surprises them. Second of all, you know, voting's a right, but you're not required to, and some people just don't vote. I mean, they don't want to. They don't want to register. They don't want anything to do with it, and so they don't like the fact that their neighbors are involved. So that's it. That's the maybe the downside to that. And so campaigns have to be careful on how that works. So as I mentioned, we've been working for 2 years. And by the way, if you have any questions, just raise your hand. I'm happy to answer them as we go. So we've been preparing. We had the redistricting, which we worked hard on last year, and had that done the first of this year. We also did a new thing this year that the statute requires us. Usually, when you see your ballot and you see the order the candidates are on there, that's based upon the county clerk deciding what order he or she wants. And you have a couple of Democratic county clerks in Utah, not very many, but they would put the Democrats first, and all the rest would likely put the Republican first since they were Republican. And so you may have heard about studies over the years where if the candidate who's on top of the ballot gets between a 1.5% and 2% advantage. I don't necessarily believe that, but some people do. And so what the legislature did is said, okay, at the beginning of the year, before you know who the candidates are, who's going to file, who, you know, the opponents and what office are up, why don't you take the alphabet and randomize it, and that's going to be the order that you will place the candidates on the ballot. So what we did you take the alphabet, A, B, C, D, you know, 26 letters, and then we put it into an Excel random generator. And so you put it in there, you hit F9, and it randomized the alphabet. So, you know, you have R first, and then C, and then so on down. So it's all randomized. And so the candidates who go and file for office in March, their last names, their surnames, that's how they're going to be placed on the ballot, depending on where they fall in that randomized thing. And so that's going to be new this year, and so we'll be interested to see how that turns out. We've already received complaints. Our office, we get every complaint that you can imagine. I tell you, we had a complaint. In fact, we had a complaint on Friday with someone calling and saying, "Hey, there's a guy at a polling location. He's taking pictures. You got to get down here." And we said, "Okay, well, does he have a big camera? What does he do? Is he taking pictures of other people's ballot? What is he doing?" And they said, "Well, every time he blinks, I hear a click." So apparently, he was walking around and they heard a click, and so I think that was probably an unstable person believing that someone's walking around taking pictures with their eyes. But so we get interesting issues like that. But we've had people complain about the randomized process, saying, "Hey, you know, you knew that Matheson was going to run in this district, and you knew that he was going to have this opponent or that opponent, and so you guys manipulated the randomized, you know, alphabet." So we get complaints like that all the time, and that's probably one of the difficult parts of the office is you know, when people call us and say, hey, you know, on election day, who do I call if my voting doesn't go right? And we always say, well, the same people you would call if voting goes very good for you. And they say, well, who's that? We say, well, our office, of course, you know. So they don't, you know, we get all the complaints, but no one ever calls and tells us, hey, you know, you guys did a great job. And so that's the hard part, and that's part of government that we face. Yes, right here, question.
My name's Clint Williams. I was just curious, how long has the early voting process been happening here in Utah? And how's it been received from candidates? It sounded like pretty positive. But if all the people liked it, I mean, is it a good thing?
So early voting began in 2006, and it was in regards to the voting equipment. Because we needed, we purchased all of the touchscreen voting equipment, but if we wanted to have enough machines to accommodate everyone on election day, we would have to spend millions and millions and millions more dollars on machines. So other states had done early voting. It was successful, so we implemented it here. And so for 2 weeks now, before Election Day, the early voting locations are available. So that obviously spreads out voting, so we don't have to have all those machines on Election Day. And so that's the primary reason administratively. I think for the public, it's a convenience factor. A lot of people talk about turnout. Is that going to raise turnout? We haven't necessarily seen it. I think mostly because those folks who are going to vote on Election Day are now just going to go vote, you know, sometime during the early voting period. So it's really a convenience factor that we've heard some great things from the public on. They really like that. Salt Lake and Davis County, a couple other counties, they're even opening their early voting locations late, you know, 7, 8 o'clock at night, which we've heard from a lot of folks. They like that, you know, being able to get off work and then go to those locations after. They had Trolley Square had a early voting locations just down here. So it's been well received, and the numbers keep going up. I mean, we may even hit 50% of people who vote before Election Day come by the time tomorrow comes. So.
Hi, my name is Park Lundgren. I'm a political science major. I was just wondering, they were talking about education, that's their second priority, is to improve education in the state of Utah. But we do have one of the, our education system obviously isn't the best, like you look at a nationwide scale. I was wondering, what do they plan to do different this next term?
Well, I don't work too much on the campaign and the political side, but I can tell you, you know, as I go around talking with people also, you hear about funding. And they say, you know, and for a lot of people, the solution is just add more money, add more money. They don't want to look at the other issues that are accompanying education. And it's interesting, as my daughter now has just began kindergarten, you know, 2 months ago, and my outlook on education is completely different than it was 2 months ago. It's interesting how that changes your thoughts. These community councils that are there, the back school, you know, the teachers, you want to make sure they have good teachers. And so it does change us quite a bit. But from my understanding and from what I believe, too, it's going to be several things that's going to take change. And part of that is funding, but a part of that is making schools accountable. Part of that is making teachers accountable. And so I think it's going to be an effort. We've also had a lot of outside organizations, private entities, who have stepped up to either offer volunteers at the schools to help with those students who are maybe lagging behind. As someone who lives downtown, we have a mixed population there, and my wife went into the school and to help them with the computer lab, and you know, a lot of kids nowadays, I mean, they're doing the computers, they know it quite well. But for some of these minority kids, I mean, that's a challenge, you know. Put the mouse on the top of the screen and they, you know, the mouse, what's the mouse? They don't know what the mouse is. And then they figure out what the mouse is, and they literally put it on top of the screen. I mean, they don't know. And so that's where I think having these private entities and volunteers come in and help makes a difference too. Yes, question back here.
Yeah, my name is Kyle Perkins, and as the director of elections, what's the biggest issue or problem you're facing right now, and how are you working to solve that?
Well, probably one of the big issues that we face in the elections office is we have a turnout problem in Utah. You know, it's not as bad as I think some people say, but we are definitely below the national average. And you know, as I looked at the lieutenant governor and as he lays this out, I thought it was interesting as I thought through some of the things that we've worked through as with that, and turnout is one of them. You know, I don't think there's a magic bullet there. I think it's a combination of things. I think it's Utah has by 8 years one of the youngest populations in the United States, and we know that younger folks they tend to vote at a less than older folks. So I think that's part of it. We try hard. We have a group. In fact, we meet with all of the college presidents every month leading up to Election Day, and we have a contest. Right now, you guys are in a contest, believe it or not, with other colleges to get people registered to vote, to get people to go to the website, find their polling location. So we do that, but so that's one reason. The other is having a dominated state, a Republican-dominated state, makes a difference. I lived in Utah County for a couple of years, and I would go to the ballot, and in a general election year, and I would see 3, 4, 5 races uncontested whatsoever, with just a Republican on there, and that's not going to get anyone out to vote. I mean, certainly all the campaign has to do is, you know, have one person vote and the guy wins or the girl wins, you know, so they're not going to spend any money. You think of John Huntsman, when he was in a contested race with Matheson for governor, millions of dollars were spent to get out the vote effort and to make sure voters were aware of the issues. But 4 years later, running against Bob Springmeier, you know, not too many people heard of him. It just wasn't too contested. You know, he spent $200,000. And so I think that makes a difference too. Is some of those the spending levels? Our office has a campaign where we get people not only out to vote but also educated on the issues, and that we try to lead people to our website, vote.utah.gov, where you can register, you can request a by mail ballot, you can look at your sample ballot. You can look at the issues, the pro, the cons, and partial analysis. Candidates provide us their biographical information along with their website, so we go to you can link to there. So that's part of it. But I think in the end, it's probably going to come down to no matter how hard we work, we can probably uptick it a few. But it's going to come down to having some contested races and getting people out, and what candidates you have on the ballot. You may have heard recently too about Salt Lake County and some of the other counties had removed about 76,000 voters from the rolls earlier this year. And you have some groups who said, well, wait a minute, you're removing these voters? Are you kidding me? You know, in election year, what are you guys doing? And there's a federal and state statutory process that the counties follow and in removing voters. And some people ask, well, why do you remove them anyway? I mean, just leave them on there. What does it hurt to have these people on there? In the case of over 60,000 of these. Salt Lake County had waited 8 to 12 years with no activity whatsoever, with multiple letters going out to these folks and with no response from them. And so actually after 4 years of no response, the clerk said, or the state and federal law say you can remove them. But the clerk waited 8 to 12 years and had them removed. But you have those folks who think, you know, there's a conspiracy in anything and everything and wonder why, you know, we're doing that. The reason I bring that up is because that affects voter turnout. I mean, the denominator that we use makes a difference. So by doing nothing more than just removing voters who haven't voted or responded or anything in 8 to 12 years, we brought up our turnout by almost 8%, just removing those voters. And when we are on a national average, you know, just a couple of tenths of a point behind being in the mix of another 15 other states, I mean, that jump makes a huge difference. And so that's one of the other things that we're doing is making sure that, you know, we have clean and accurate voter rolls. Now, when these voters are removed, we actually just, you think of an electronic file, we just don't remove them and throw the file away. We put them into another file called holding, the holding file. And so if for some reason one of these voters come in on election day and they, you know, they haven't responded to anything for 8 to 12 years and they pop up back on the grid, well, we still have their information. All we have to do is remove them from the holding, put them back into the active file, and we'll count their vote. And so it's a good process, but I know for a lot of folks, their belief, or I should say for some folks, their belief is voter registration. We ought to just keep it there and just let it keep adding up. People don't update their information. I mean, how many times have you all moved in the last 3 or 4 years? I mean, and have you updated your registration information? Likely not. And so that's what we're dealing with the general public, is getting them to update their information. So let's see. Electronic signatures. Have you guys heard about that issue lately? So a couple of years ago, we had a candidate who came into our office who was a candidate for governor. And he was an unaffiliated candidate, which means he has to turn in signatures in order to be on the ballot. He has to turn in 1,000 signatures. Well, he turned in 950 signatures, yet with the last 50, he gave us a type list of names and said, well, these people went to my website and they signed my petition to be on the ballot. And we said, well, you know, the statute lays out a paper process where you would go, you know, you might see them out there on Walmart or Smith's, the people out there say, hey, will you sign my petition? They like to come on campus to get folks. And so it's usually a paper process, but this guy decided to do an electronic process. And we said, well, no, we don't think so. You know, the statute lays out a paper process, and, you know, all you have is a type list of names here. So what we decided to do is deny it. He came back and filed in the Supreme Court. Supreme Court came back and said, well, actually, no, he's right. You know, electronic signature is electronic signature. It could be, the statute says if you have an electronic signature, if you have a handwritten signature or electronic signature, it's considered a valid signature. And we disagreed with that because the next section of the law said, and a government agency doesn't have to accept electronic signatures unless they want to. So, and we said, look, we just can't accept a type list of names. So he got on the ballot, which is fine, but it did get us thinking about how we can move forward with this. And so the legislature went in and changed the law and made it clear that you cannot use electronic signatures. So they took it completely off the table. And then they came back. And then they came back and said, however, we would like the lieutenant governor's office to study this. And so beginning on Wednesday after the election, our office is going to be sitting down with security experts, computer experts, people who are in the circulating petition realm to help us come up to with a process and a procedure on, is it possible to collect these signatures online, to have someone go to a website, look at a petition and say, yes, I want to sign that petition, and type their name and have it be valid, and have it a process that people are confident is a valid process, that is secure process. So that's an exciting one that I think as you all get older, that you'll see that much more. And I think we're almost out of time.
That's the conclusion of our
Okay, so we are out of time. Thank you.